taking her from where she had been waiting. No sense having my presence detected by leaving her parked in plain view. Because of the peculiar shape of Miss Mountjoy's property, the coach house was located at the end of a hedge-lined L-shaped lane that ran along one side and across the back. I tucked Gladys out of sight behind a box hedge and proceeded on foot. As I approached the building, I could see that the term coach house was no more than a courtesy title. In fact, it was almost a joke. The building was square, with bricks on the bottom floor and boards on the top. The windows were coated with the kind of opaque film that tells of neglect and cobwebs, the kind of windows that watch you. The door had once been painted, but had blistered away to reveal grey, weathered wood that matched the unpainted boards of the upper story. I wrapped my hand in the handkerchief and tried the latch. The door was locked. The first floor windows were too high to gain entry, and the tangle of ivy on a broken trellis too fragile to climb. A rickety ladder leaned wearily against the wall, too dangerous to be pressed into service. I decided to try round the back. I had to be careful. Only a sagging wooden fence and a narrow walkway separated the rear of the coach house from Miss Mountjoy's overhanging willow tree. I'd have to crouch and run, like a commando on the beach. At the end of the fence, on the left side of the walkway, was a wire compound attached to the coach house, from which issued, as I approached, an excited clucking. Inside the compound, there was a cage no more than 2 feet high, rather less, in fact, and in it was the biggest rooster I had ever seen, so large that he had to strut about his cage with stooped shoulders. As soon as he saw me, the bird made for the wires that separated us, fluttering up towards my face with a frightening rustle of wings. My first instinct was to take to my heels, but then I saw the pleading look in his marmalade eye. He was hungry. I took a handful of feed from a box that was nailed to the framework of the cage and tossed it through the mesh. The rooster fell upon the stuff like a wolf upon Russian travellers, his comb, as red as paper poppies, bobbing busily up and down as if it were driven by steam. As he feasted, I noticed a hatch on the far side of the cage that opened into the coach house. It was no more than rooster-sized, but it would do. Throwing a couple more handfuls of feed to distract the bird, I turned to the wire fence. It was only about 7 feet high, but too far to leap up and grasp the upper frame. I tried to swarm up the mesh, but my shoes could find no grip. Undefeated, I sat down and removed my shoes and socks. When I come to write my autobiography, I must remember to record the fact that a chicken wire fence can be scaled by a girl in bare feet, but only by one who is willing to suffer the tortures of the damned to satisfy her curiosity. As I climbed, my toes stuck through the hexagons of the wire mesh, each strand like the blades of a cheese cutter. By the time I reached the top, my feet felt as if they belonged to Scott of the Antarctic. As I dropped to the ground on the inside of the enclosure, the rooster made a lunge for me. Since I hadn't thought to bring a pocket full of feed to appease the famished bird, I was at his mercy. He threw himself at my bare knees, and I made a dive for the hatchway. It was a tight fit, and I could only square my way painfully through the opening as the enraged bird pecked furiously at my legs. But moments later, I was inside the coach house, still inside a wired partition, but inside. And so was the rooster, who had followed me in and was now flinging himself upon me like an avenging fury. Seized by a sudden inspiration, I squatted, caught the bird's eye, then with a loud hissing, rose up suddenly to my full height, weaving my head and flicking my tongue in and out like a king cobra. It worked! In his feeble rooster brain, some age-old instinct whispered a sudden wordless tale of terror that involved a chicken and a snake, and taking to his heels, he shot out through the hatch like a feathered cannonball. I poked my fingers through the mesh and rotated the strip of wood that served as a latch, then stepped into the corridor. I suppose my mind had been filled with images of dusty box stalls, of shriveled harness hanging from wooden pegs, of curry combs and benches, and perhaps a long abandoned phaeton carriage lurking in some dim corner. Perhaps I was thinking of our own coach house at Buckshaw. But whatever the case, I was totally unprepared for what I saw. Beneath the low beamed ceiling of what had once been a stable, couches upholstered in green and pink silk were jammed together like buses in Piccadilly Circus. Cameo jars and vases, some of them surely Wedgwood, stood here and there on tables whose old wood managed to glow even in the dim light. Carved cabinets and elaborately inlaid tables receded into the shadows, while nearby horse stalls overflowed with Royal Albert ewers and oriental screens. The place was a warehouse, and, I thought, no ordinary one at that. Against one wall, almost hidden by a massive sideboard, was an exquisitely carved Georgian chimney piece, in front of which, half unrolled, was a rich and elaborate carpet. Something very much like it had been pointed out to me on more than one occasion by Feely's friend and toady, Sheila Foster, who managed to drag their carpet into even the most casual conversation. "The Archbishop of Canterbury was down for the weekend, you know. As he was pinching my cheek, he dropped a crumb of his Dundee cake on our dear old Orbison." I had just stepped forward to have a closer look at the thing when something caught my eye, a gleam in a dark corner by the chimney-piece. I sucked in my breath, for there, in Miss Mountjoy's coach-house, stood Sally Fox and Shoppo, Harriet's brass fire-irons. "What on earth?" I thought. "How can this be?" I had seen the fire-dogs just hours before in the drawing-room at Buckshaw. Brookie Harewood couldn't possibly have crept back into the house and stolen them, because Brookie was dead. But who else could have brought them here? Could it have been Colin Prout? Colin was, after all, Brookie's puppet, and I had found him hanging about the neighbourhood just minutes ago. Did Colin live here with Brookie? Miss Mountjoy had referred to Brookie as her tenant, which surely meant that he lived here. I hadn't seen any sign of a kitchen or sleeping quarters, but perhaps they lay somewhere beyond the vast expanse of furniture or upstairs on the first floor. As I retraced my steps to the central corridor, a car door slammed in the lane outside. Crackers! It could well be Inspector Hewitt! I ducked down and waddled my way towards a window where I pressed myself flat against the back of a massive ebony armoire, round which I could peek out without being seen. But it was not Inspector Hewitt who was coming towards the door. It was a walking bulldog. The man's shirt sleeves were rolled to his elbows, revealing arms that, except for their excessive hairiness, might have been a pair of Christmas hams. His shirt, open at the neck, revealed a forest of black, springy chest hair, and his fists clenched and unclenched as he strode purposefully towards the door. Whoever he was, it was clear that he was unhappy. The man was powerful enough to tear me open like a packet of cigarettes. I couldn't let him find me here. It was unnerving to work my way back through the maze of furniture. Twice I startled at a movement close by, only to find that it was a reflection of myself in an uncovered mirror. The man was already opening the door as I reached the caged cubicle. I slipped inside, thank goodness for bare feet and straw on the floor, then lowered myself to hands and knees, then flat on my face, and began to crawl through the narrow hole to the outside. The rooster was on me like a champion fighting cock. As I crawled, I tried to keep my hands up to protect my face, but the bird's spurs were razor sharp. Before I was even halfway through, my wrists were bleeding. Up the wire wall I swarmed, the rooster throwing himself again and again at my feet and legs. There was no time even to think of what the wire mesh was doing to my toes. At the top, I threw myself over the wooden bar and dropped heavily to the ground.
"Who's there?"
Inside the coach house, the man's voice sounded as if he was no more than a few feet away. but unless he got down on his belly and crawled, he could not follow me, could not even see me in the outside pen. He would have to return to his car, then come round behind the coach house in the lane. I heard his footsteps retreating on the wooden floor. Again I made a crouching scuttle along the crumbling fence. But wait! I'd forgotten my shoes and socks! Back again I went to retrieve them, my breath now coming in quick, painful gasps. Once more along the fence, and I ducked behind the hedge where I had left Gladys. Just in time. I froze behind the box hedge, trying not to breathe as the human bulldog went lumbering past.
"Who's there?" he demanded again,
and I heard the rooster throw himself at the wire mesh with a wild crowing. A few more coarse oaths and my pursuer was gone. I cannot bring myself to record his exact words, but will keep them in mind against the day I can put them to good use. I waited for a minute or two to be sure, then dragged Gladys from behind the hedge and set off for home. As I paddled along, I did my best to look like a respectable English girl out for a bracing bicycle ride in the fresh air. But somehow I doubted that my charade would convince anyone. My hands and face were filthy, my wrists and ankles were bleeding, my knees were scraped to the bone, and my clothing would have to be tossed in the dustbin. Father would not be amused. And what if, in my absence, they had discovered porcelain in my bedroom? What if she had awakened and wandered downstairs? Or into Father's study? Although I had never before cringed on a bicycle, I cringed. "I caught her crawling in at one of the windows of the picture gallery," Feely said, "like a common housebreaker. Can you imagine? I'd gone there to study the Mags painting of Ajax and..." Mags was a ruffian painter who had lived in the vicinity of Bishop's Lacey during the Regency, and Ajax, a horse that had been bought on a whim by one of my ancestors, Florizel de Luce. Ajax had rewarded his new owner by going on to win enough races that Florizel was able to have himself elected to a rotten borough.
"Thank you, Ophelia," Father said.
Feely cast down humble eyes and drifted out the door, where she would sit on the chair in the hallway to eavesdrop comfortably upon my humiliation.
"Do you know what day it is, Flavia?"
Father began. "Sunday," I said without hesitation, although yesterday's fete at St. Tancred's seemed as far removed in time as the last ice age.
"Precisely," Father said. "And what have we done on Sunday since time immemorial?"
"Gone to church," I replied, like a trained macaw. "Church! I'd forgotten all about it."
"I'd thought to let you lie in this morning to recover from that nasty business in the Parlings. Next thing I know, there's an inspector at the door and you're wanted for fingerprinting. Now I'm informed that there's a dead body on the Trafalgar lawn and that you're nosing about the village, asking impertinent questions."
"Miss Mountjoy," I ventured. "Give a little, learn a lot." That was going to be my motto of the month. I would have to remember to jot it down in my notebook. But wait, how could Miss Mountjoy have known about the body on the lawn? Unless...
"Miss Mountjoy," Father confirmed. "She telephoned to ask if you'd got home safely."
"The old harpy. She must have got up from her settee and been peering out through the trailing seaweed fronds of the willow tree, spying on my encounters with the rooster and the bulldog man." "How very kind of her," I said. "I must remember to send her a card."
"I'd send her a card, all right. It would be the Ace of Spades, and I'd mail it anonymously from somewhere other than Bishop's Lacey.
Philip O'Dell, the detective on the wireless, had once investigated such a case, and it had been a cracking good story, one of his best adventures."
"And your dress?" Father went on. "What have you done to your dress?"
"My dress? Hadn't Miss Mountjoy described to him fully what she'd seen? Hold on. Perhaps she hadn't after all. Perhaps Father was still unaware of what had taken place at the coach house." God bless you, Miss Mountjoy, I thought. May you live forever in the company of those saints and martyrs who refused to tell them where the church plate was buried. But wasn't Father going to remark upon my cuts and abrasions? Apparently not. And it was at that moment, I think, it began to dawn upon me, truly dawn upon me, that there were things that were never mentioned in polite company, no matter what, that blue blood was heavier than red, that manners and appearances and the stiff upper lip were all of them more important, even, than life itself.
Flavia, Father repeated, fighting to keep from wringing his hands. I asked you a question. What have you done to your dress?
I looked down at myself as if noticing the damage for the first time. My dress, I said, smoothing it down and making sure he had a good view of my bloodied wrist and knees. Oh, I'm sorry, Father. It's nothing. I had a bit of a prang with my bicycle. Jolly bad luck. But still, I'll rinse it out at once and mend it myself. It'll be a piece of cake. My acute hearing detected the sound of a coarse snicker in the hallway. But I'd like to believe that what I saw in Father's eyes was pride. Chapter 12. Porcelain was sleeping the sleep of the dead. I had worried in vain. I stood looking down at her as she lay on my bed, in much the same position as when I had left her. The dark swatches under her eyes seemed to have lightened, and her breathing was almost imperceptible. 2 seconds later, there was a flurry of furious motion, and I was pinned to the bed with Porcelain thumbs pressing into my windpipe. Fiend, I thought she hissed. I struggled to get free, but I couldn't move. Bright stars were bursting in my brain as I clawed at her hands. I wasn't getting enough oxygen. I tried to pull away. But I was no match for her. She was bigger and stronger than me, and already I could feel myself becoming languid and uncaring. How easy it would be to give in. But no, I stopped trying to fight her hands and instead took hold of her nose with my thumb and forefinger. With my last remaining strength, I gave it a most vicious twist. Flavia? She seemed suddenly surprised to see me. As if we were old friends who had met unexpectedly in front of a lovely Vermeer in the National Gallery. Her hands withdrew themselves from my throat, but still I couldn't seem to breathe. I rolled off the bed and onto the floor, seized with a fit of coughing. What are you doing? She demanded, looking round in puzzlement.
What are you doing? I croaked. You've crushed my windpipe.
Oh, God, she said. How awful. I'm sorry, Flavia, really I am. I was dreaming I was in Finella's caravan, and there was some horrid beast standing over me. I think it was.
Yes?
She looked away from me. I'm sorry. I can't tell you.
I'll keep it to myself, I promise.
No, it's no good. I mustn't.
All right, then, I said. Don't. In fact, I forbid you to tell me.
Flavia, no, I said, and I meant it. I don't want to know. Let's talk about something else. I knew that if I bided my time, whatever it was that Porcelain was withholding would come spilling out like minced pork from Mrs. Mullet's meat grinder. Which reminded me that I hadn't eaten for ages. Are you hungry? I asked. Starving. You must have heard my tummy rumbling. I hadn't, but I pretended I had and nodded wisely.
Stay here. I'll bring something from the kitchen.
10 minutes later, I was back with a bowl of food nicked from the pantry. Follow me, I said, next door. Porcelain looked round wide-eyed as we entered my chemical laboratory.
What is this place? Are we supposed to be in here?
Of course we are, I told her. It's where I do my experiments.
Like magic? She asked, glancing round at the glassware.
Yes, I said, like magic. Now then, you take these.
She jumped at the pop of the Bunsen burner as I put a match to it.
"Hold them over the flame," I said, handing her a couple of bangers and a pair of nickel-plated test tube clamps. "Not too close. It's exceedingly hot."
I broke 6 eggs into a borosilicate evaporating dish and stirred them with a glass rod over a second burner. Almost immediately, the laboratory was filled with mouth-watering aromas.
"Now for toast," I said. "You can do 2 slices at a time," I said. "Use the tongues again. Do both sides, then turn them inside out."
By necessity, I had become quite an accomplished laboratory chef. Once, just recently, when Father had banished me to my room, I had even made myself a spotted dick by steaming suet from the larder in a wide-neck Erlenmeyer flask. And because water boils at only 212 degrees Fahrenheit, while nylon doesn't melt until it is heated to 417 degrees, I had verified my theory that one of Feely's precious stockings would make a perfect pudding bag. If there's anything more delicious than a sausage roasted over an open Bunsen burner, I can't imagine what it might be. Unless it's the feeling of freedom that comes of eating it with the bare fingers and letting the fat fall where it may. Porcelain and I tore into our food like cannibals after a missionary famine, and before long there was nothing left but crumbs. As 2 cups of water came to the boil in a glass beaker, I took down from the shelf where it was kept, alphabetically, between the arsenic and the cyanide, an apothecary jar marked Camellia sinensis. "Don't worry," I said, "it's only tea." Now there fell between us one of those silences that occur when 2 people are getting to know each other. Not yet warm and friendly, but neither cold nor wary.
"I wonder how your Gram is doing," I said at last. "Fenella, I should say."
"Well enough, I expect. She's a hard old bird."
"Tough, you mean?"
Her answer had surprised me. "I mean hard." She deliberately let go of the glass test tube she'd been toying with and watched it shatter on the floor. "But she'll not be broken," she said. I begged to differ, but I kept my mouth shut. Porcelain had not seen her grandmother, as I had, sprawled in a pool of her own blood. "Life can kill you, but only if you let it," she used to tell me that.
"You must have loved her awfully," I said, realizing even as I spoke that I made it sound as if Fenella were already dead.
"Yes, sometimes very much," Porcelain said reflectively. "And sometimes not at all."
"She must have seen my startled reaction."
"Love's not some big river that flows on and on forever, and if you believe it is, you're a bloody fool. It can be dammed up until nothing's left but a trickle."
"Or stopped completely," I added. She did not reply. I let my gaze wander out the window and across the visto, and I thought about the kinds of love I knew, which were not very many. After a while, I thought about Brookie Harewood. Who had hated him enough to kill him, I wondered, and hang him from Poseidon's trident? Or had Brookie's death come about through fear rather than hate? Well, whatever the case, Brookie would be laid out on a wheeled trolley in Hindley by now, and someone, his next of kin, would have been asked to identify the body. As an attendant in a white coat lifted the corner of a sheet to reveal Brookie's dead face, a woman would step forward. She would gasp, clap a handkerchief to her mouth, and quickly turn her head away. I knew how it was done. I'd seen it in the cinema. And unless I missed my bet, the woman would be his mother, the artist who lived in Malden Fenwick. But perhaps I was wrong. Perhaps they would spare a mother the grief. Perhaps the woman who was stepping forward was just a friend. But no, Brookie didn't seem the type to have ladies as friends. Not many women would fancy spending their nights sneaking about the countryside in rubber boots and handling dead fish.
I was so wrapped up in my thoughts that I hadn't heard Porcelain begin speaking.
"But never in summer," she was saying.
In summer, she'd chuck all that and take to the roads with Johnny Farr, and not a penny between them. Like a couple of kids they were. Johnny was a tinker when he was younger, but he'd given it up for some reason he would never explain. Still, he made friends easily enough, and his way with a fiddle meant that he spoke every language under the sun. They lived on whatever Fenella could get by telling the fortunes of fools. I was one of those fools, I told her. Yes, Porcelain said. She was not going to spare my feelings.
Did you travel with them? I asked.
Once or twice when I was younger. Lunita didn't much like me being with them.
Lunita?
My mother. She was their only child. Gypsies like large families, you know, but she was all they had. Their hearts were broken in half when she ran off with a Gaho, an Englishman from Tunbridge Wells.
Your father?
Porcelain nodded sadly. She used to tell me my father was a prince, that he rode on the back of a pure white horse that was faster than the wind. His jacket was of spun gold and his sleeves of finest silk. He could talk to the birds in their own language and make himself invisible whenever the fancy took him. Some of that was true. He was specially good at the invisible dodge.
As Porcelain spoke, there appeared in my mind a thought as sudden and as uninvited as a shooting star in the night sky. Would I trade my father for hers?
I brushed it away.
Tell me about your mother, I said, perhaps a little too eagerly.
There's little enough to tell. She was on her own. She couldn't go home, if you can call it that, because Fenella and Johnny, mostly Fenella, wouldn't have her. She'd me to care for, and she hadn't a friend in the world.
How awful, I said. How did she manage?
By doing the only thing she knew. She had the gift of the cards, so she told fortunes. Sometimes, when things got bad, she would send me to Fenella and Johnny for a while. They cared for me well enough, but when I was with them, they never asked about Lunita.
And you never told them?
No. But when the war came, things were different. We'd been living in a frightful old bedsitter in Moorgate, where Lunita told fortunes behind a bedsheet strung up across the room. I was only 4 at the time, so I don't remember much about it in those days, apart from a spider that lived in a hole in the bathroom wall. We'd been there for, oh, I think about 4 years, so I must have been 8 when one day a sign went up in the window of the empty house next door and the landlady told Lunita that the place was being turned into a servicemen's club. Suddenly, she was making more money than she knew what to do with. I think she felt guilty about all the Canadians, the Americans, the New Zealanders, and the Australians, even the Poles, that came flocking in their uniforms to our rooms to have their cards turned. She didn't want anyone to think she was profiting by the war. I'll never forget the day I found her weeping in the WC.
Those poor boys, I remember her sobbing. They all asked the same question. Will I go home alive? And what did she tell them?
You will go home in greater glory than ever you came.
She told them all the same, every one of them, 1/2 a crown a time. That's very sad, I said.
Sad?
No, not sad. Those were the best days of our lives. We just didn't realize it at the time. There was one particular officer that was always hanging around the club, tall bloke with a little blonde moustache. I used to see him in the street coming and going. Never had much to say, but he always seemed to be keeping an eye out for something. One day, just for a lark, Lunita invited him in and told his fortune. Wouldn't take a penny for it, because it happened to be on a Sunday. Within a day or two, she was working for MI something. They wouldn't tell her what, but it seemed that whatever she'd seen in his cards, she'd hit the nail on the head.
Sam Boffin in Whitehall was trying to work out what Hitler's next move was going to be, and he'd heard through the grapevine about the gypsy who spread the cards in Moorgate. They invited Lunita straight away to lunch at the Savoy. At first, it might have been no more than a game. Maybe they wanted word to get about that they were desperate enough to pin their hopes on a gypsy. But again, the thing she told them was so close to the top secret truth that they couldn't believe their ears. They'd never heard anything like it. At first, they thought she was a spy, and they had a scientist from Bletchley Park come up to London to interrogate her. He was hardly through the door before she told him he was lucky to be alive, that an illness had saved his life. And it was true. He'd just been attached to the Americans as a liaison officer when a sudden attack of appendicitis had kept him from taking part in a rehearsal for D-Day. Exercise Tiger, it was called. The thing had been badly botched, hundreds killed. It was all hushed up, of course. Nobody knew about it at the time. Needless to say, the bloke was flabbergasted. She passed the test with flying colours, and within hours, they had us set up in our own posh flat in Bloomsbury. "She must have remarkable powers," I said. Porcelain's body went slack. "Had," she said flatly. She died a month later, a V1 rocket in the street outside the Air Ministry. 6 years ago, in June. "I'm sorry," I said, and I was. At last we had something in common, Porcelain and I, even if it was no more than a mother who had died too young and left us to grow up on our own. How I longed to tell her about Harriet, but somehow I could not. The grief in the room belonged to Porcelain, and I realized almost at once that it would be selfish to rob her of it in any way. I set about cleaning up the shattered glass from the test tube she had dropped. "Here," she said, "I should be doing that." "It's all right," I told her. "I'm used to it." It was one of those made-up excuses that I generally despise. But how could I tell her the truth? That I was unwilling to share with anyone the picking up of the pieces. Was this a fleeting glimpse of being a woman? I wondered. I hoped it was, and also that it was not. We were sitting on my bed, Porcelain with her back against the head and I cross-legged at the foot. "I expect you'll be wanting to visit your Gram," I said. Porcelain shrugged, and I think I understood her. "The police don't know you're here yet. I suppose we'd better tell them." "I suppose." "Let's leave it till the morning," I told her. "I'm too tired to think." And it was true. My eyelids felt as if they had been hung with lead sinkers. I was simply too exhausted to deal with the problems at hand. The greatest of these would be to keep secret Porcelain's presence in the house. The last thing I needed was to look on helplessly as Father drove away the granddaughter of Fenella and Johnny Farr. Fenella was in hospital in Henley and, for all I knew, she might be dead by now. If I was to get to the bottom of the attack upon her at the Parlings and, I suspected, the murder of Brookie Harewood, I would have to attract as little attention as possible. It was only a matter of time before Inspector Hewitt would be at the door demanding details about how I had discovered Brookie's body. I needed time to review which facts I would tell him and which I would not. Or did I? My mind was a whirl. "Hey ho," I thought, "what jolly sport is the world of Flavia de Luce?" Next thing I knew it was morning, and sunlight was pouring in through the windows. Chapter 13. I rolled over and blinked. I had been sprawled across the bottom of the bed, my head twisted painfully against the footboard. At the top of the bed, Porcelain was tucked in with my blanket pulled over her shoulders, her head on my pillow, sleeping away for all she was worth like some oriental princess. For a moment, I felt my resentment rising. But when I remembered the tale she had told me last night, I let the resentment melt into pity. I glanced at the clock and saw, to my horror, that I had overslept. I was late for breakfast. Father insisted that dishes at the table arrive and be taken away with military precision. Taking great care not to awaken Porcelain, I made a quick change of clothing, took a swipe at my hair with a brush, and crept down to breakfast. Father, as usual, was immersed in the latest number of the London Philatelist and seemed hardly to notice my arrival, a sure sign that another philatelic auction was about to take place. If our financial condition was as precarious as he claimed, he'd need to be sharp about current prices. As he ate, he made little notes on a napkin with the stub of a pencil, his mind in another world. As I slipped into my chair, Feely fixed me with the cold and stony stare she had perfected by watching Queen Mary in the newsreels. "You have a pimple on your face," I said matter-of-factly as I poured milk on my Weetabix. She pretended she didn't hear me, but less than a minute later, I was gratified to see her hand rise automatically to her cheek and begin its exploration. It was like watching a crab crawl slowly across the seabed in one of the full-coloured short subjects at the cinema, The Living Ocean, or something like that. "Careful, Feely," I said. "It's going to explode." Daffy looked up from her book, the copy of A Looking Glass for London and England I had found at the fete. "She picked it up herself, the swine. I made a note to steal it later." "What does it mean where it says, 'A red herring without mustard?'" I asked, pointing. Daffy loved the slightest opportunity to show off her superior knowledge. I had already reviewed in my mind what I knew about mustard, which was precious little. I knew, for instance, that it contained, among other things, the acids oleic, erucic, behenic, and stearic. I knew that stearic acid was found in beef and mutton suet, because I had once subjected one of Mrs. Mallet's greasy Sunday roasts to chemical analysis, and I had looked up the fact that erucic acid gets its name from the Greek word meaning to vomit. "Red herring, in the 16th and 17th centuries, was considered an inferior dish," Daffy replied, with an especially withering look at me on the word inferior. I glanced over at Father to see if he was looking, but he wasn't. "Nicholas Brayton called it a good gross dish for a coarse stomach," she went on, squirming and preening in her chair. "He also said that old ling, that's another fish in case you don't know, is like a blue coat without cognizance, which means a servant who doesn't wear his master's badge of arms."
"Daphne, please," Father said, without looking up, and she subsided.
I knew that they were referring, over my head, they thought, to Dogger. Warfare at Buckshaw was like that, invisible and sometimes silent.
"Pass the toast, please," Daffy said, as quietly and politely as if she were addressing a stranger in an ABC tea shop, as if the last 11 years of my life hadn't happened.
"They're having a new badminton court at Foster's," Feely remarked suddenly to no one in particular. "Sheila's going to use the old one to park her Daimler." Father grunted, but I could tell he was no longer listening.
"She's such a saucy stick," Feely went on. "She had Copley bring out little dishes of dessert onto the south lawn, but instead of ices, she serves snails, escargot. We ate them raw, like oysters, as the cinema stars do. It was ever so amusing."
"You'd better be careful," I said. "The snail gatherers sometimes pick up leeches by mistake. If you swallow a leech, it will eat its way out of your stomach from the inside." Feely's face drained slowly, like a wash basin.
"There was something in the Hindley Chronicle," I added helpfully, 3 weeks ago, if I remember correctly, about a man from St. Elfrida's, not that far from here, really, who swallowed a leech and they had to..." But Feely had scraped back her chair and fled.
Are you provoking your sister again, Flavia?
Father asked, looking up from his journal, but leaving a forefinger on the page to mark his place.
I was trying to discuss current events, I said, but she doesn't seem much interested.
Ah, Father said, and went back to reading about plate floors in the 1840 Tuppenny Blue. With Father present at the table, we were at least semi-civilized. I made my escape with surprisingly little difficulty.
Mrs. Mullet was in the kitchen, torturing the corpse of a chicken with a ball of butcher's twine.
No good roasting 'em unless you truss properly, she said. That's what Mrs. Chadwick up at Norton Old Hall used to tell me, and she ought to know. She was the one that learned me, mind you, that was back in the days of Lady Rexwell's, long before you was born, dear. Truss 'em up 3 times 3, she used to say, and you'll never have to rake out your oven.
What are you laughing at, miss?
A nervous titter had escaped me as a sudden image of being tied up in a similar way by my own flesh and blood had flashed across my mind. The very thought of it reminded me that I had not yet taken my revenge. Certainly, there had been my little leech joke, but that was a mere warm-up, no more than a prelude to vengeance. The fact was that I had simply been too busy. As Mrs. M. slid the doomed bird into the maw of the open agar, I took the opportunity to pinch a pot of strawberry jam from the pantry. 3 times 3, I said, with an awful grimace and a horrid wink at Mrs. Mullet, as if I were giving the password of a secret society, one in which she and I were the only members. At the same time, I gave her a Winston Churchill V for Victory sign with my right hand, to divert attention from the jam jar in my left. Safely back upstairs, I opened the bedroom door as quietly as possible. There was no need to disturb Porcelain. I would leave a note telling her that I'd be back later, and that was all. No need to say where I was going. But no note was necessary. The bed was perfectly made and Porcelain was gone.
Confound her, I thought. Hadn't she understood that she was to keep to my room and out of sight? I thought I had made that perfectly clear, but perhaps I hadn't. Where was she now? Wandering the halls of Buckshaw, where she would surely be caught? Or had she returned to the caravan in the Parlings? I'd been intending to accompany her to the police station in Bishop's Lacey so that she could make her presence known to Constable Linnet. By being on the spot, I'd be not only doing my duty, but putting myself in the perfect position to overhear anything that passed between Porcelain and the police. P.C. Linnet would, in turn, inform his superiors in Hindley, who would pass the word to Inspector Hewitt. And I'd be the recipient of his grateful thanks.
It could have been so simple. Damn the girl!
Back through the kitchen I trudged with a second-degree wink to Mrs. Mullet and a muttered 3 times 3. Gladys was waiting by the garden wall and Dogger was in the greenhouse, intent upon his work. But as I pedalled away, I was aware of his eyes upon my back. Malden Fenwick lay to the east of Bishop's Lacey, not far beyond Chipford. Although I had never been there before, the place had a familiar look. And no wonder. The prettiest village in England, as it was sometimes called, had been photographed almost to distraction. Its Elizabethan and Georgian cottages, thatched and timbered, with their hollyhocks and diamond-paned windows, its duck pond and its tithe barn, had appeared not just in hundreds of books and magazines, but as a setting for several popular films, such as Honey for Sale and Miss Jenks Goes to War.
Trellis Terraces, Daffy called it.
This was the place where Brookie Harewood's mother lived and had her studio, although I hadn't the faintest idea which of the cottages might be hers. A green charabanc was parked in front of the Bull, its passengers spilling forth into the high street, cameras at the ready, fanning out in every direction with dangling arms like a gaggle of gunfighters. Several elderly villagers, caught out of doors in their gardens, began furtively fluffing up their hair or straightening their ties, even as shutters began to click. I parked Gladys against an ancient elm and walked round the coach.
"Good morning," I said to a lady in a sun hat, as if I were helping to organize the tea. "Welcome to Malden Fenwick. And where are you from?"
"Oh, Mel," she said, turning to a man behind her. "Listen to her accent. Isn't she adorable? We're from Yonkers, New York, sweetheart. I'll bet you don't know where that is."
As a matter of fact, I did. Yonkers was the home of Leo Baekeland, the Belgian chemist who had accidentally discovered polyoxybenzyl methylenglycol anhydride, better known as Bakelite, while working to produce a synthetic replacement for shellac, which, until Baekeland came along, had been made from the secretions of the lac beetle.
"Oh yes," I said, "I think I've heard of Yonkers." I attached myself to Mel, who was busily arming his camera, as he strolled off towards a wash-painted cottage, dragging along behind him, with slack bones and downcast eyes, a sulking daughter who looked fed to the gills with transatlantic travel. Shifting from foot to foot, I waited as he fired off a couple of shots of a white-haired woman in tweeds who was perched precariously on a ladder, deadheading a climbing rosebush. As Mel wandered off in search of new memories, I lingered for a moment at the gate, pretending to admire the garden, and then, as if awakening from a partial trance, put on my best attempt at an American accent. "Say," I called out, pointing to the village green, "isn't this where what's-her-name lives, the painter lady?" "Vanetta Harewood, Glebe Cottage," the woman said cheerily, waving her secateurs. "Last one on the right." It was so easy, I was almost ashamed of myself. So that was her name, Vanetta. Vanetta Harewood. It certainly had the right ring to it for someone who painted the gentry with their hounds and horses. Barging in on a freshly bereaved mother was not, perhaps, in the best of taste, but there were things I needed to know before the police knew them. I owed as much to Fenella Farr, and to a lesser degree, to my own family. Why, for instance, had I found Vanetta Harewood's son in the drawing room at Buckshaw in the middle of the night, just before he was murdered? I didn't expect his mother knew the answer to that. But mightn't she give me some scrap of information that would allow me to find it out for myself? As the woman with the secateurs had said, Glebe Cottage was the last one on the right. It was twice the size of the others, as if two cottages had been shoved together end to end, like dominoes to form a larger one. Each half had its own front door, its own leaded window, and its own chimney. Each half of the house was the mirror image of the other. There was only one gate, though, and on it was a small brass plaque upon which was engraved, Vanetta Harewood, Portraitist. My mind flew back to a spring evening, upon which Daffy, during one of Father's compulsory literary evenings, had read aloud to us excerpts from Boswell's The Life of Samuel Johnson, LLD. And I remembered that Johnson had declared portrait painting to be an improper employment for a woman. "Public practice of any art, and staring in men's faces, is very indelicate in a female," he had said. Well, I'd seen Dr. Johnson's face in the book's frontispiece, and I couldn't imagine anyone, male or female, wanting to stare into it for any length of time. The man was an absolute toad. Behind the gate, the garden of Glebe Cottage was a mass of electric blue. The tall delphiniums in their second blooming seemed to stand on tiptoe behind the salvia, trying desperately to be first to touch the sky. Dogger had once told me that although delphiniums could be made to bloom again by cutting them down low after their first flowering, no honest gardener would dream of doing so, since it weakened the stock. Whatever else she might be, Vanetta Harewood was not an honest gardener. I touched my finger to the china doorbell button and gave it a jab. As I waited for someone to answer, I stepped back and stared up in an interested way at the sky, pursing my lips as if I were whistling carelessly.
You never knew. Someone might be peeking out from behind the curtains, and it was important to look harmless.
I waited, then pushed the button again. There was a scurrying inside the house, followed by a grating noise directly behind the door, as if someone were moving a barricade of furniture. As the door opened, I almost gasped aloud. Standing in front of me was a muscular woman in riding breeches and a lavender blouse. Her short grey hair lay tightly against her head like an aluminum helmet. She screwed a tortoise-shell monocle into her eye and peered at me.
"Yes?" "Mrs. Harewood?"
"No," she said, and shut the door in my face.
"Very well, then."
I remembered Father remarking once that if rudeness was not attributable to ignorance, it could be taken as a sure sign that one was speaking to a member of the aristocracy. I pushed the bell again. I would ask for directions. But this time the door stayed closed, and the house behind it remained in silence.
But wait, the cottage had two front doors. I had simply chosen the wrong one.
I gave myself a knuckle on the head and walked to the other door. I raised the door knocker and gave it a gentle tap. The door flew open instantly, and there stood Riding Breeches, glaring at me for all she was worth, though not through her monocle this time.
"May I speak to Mrs. Harewood?" I ventured. "It's about..."
"No," she said loudly. "Go away." But before she could slam the door, a voice came from somewhere inside the house.
"Who is it, Ursula?"
"A girl selling something," she called over her shoulder. And to me, "Go away, we don't want any biscuits."
I saw my opportunity and I took it.
"Mrs. Harewood," I shouted, "it's about Brookie."
It was as if I had cast a spell in frozen time. For what seemed like forever, the woman at the door stood perfectly motionless, gaping at me as if she were a life-size painted cutout from a picture book. She didn't even breathe.
"Mrs. Harewood, please. It's Flavia Deluce from Bishop's Lacey."
"Show her in, Ursula," the voice said.
As I brushed past her and into the narrow hallway, Ursula didn't move a muscle.
"In here,"
the voice said, and I moved towards it. I suppose I was half expecting to find a decayed Miss Havisham clinging to her mouldy treasures in the curtained cave of a drawing room. What I found was altogether different. Vannetta Harewood stood in a beam of sunlight at the bow window, and she turned to hold out her hands to me as I entered.
"Thank you for coming," she said.
She looked, I thought, to be about 45. But surely she must be much older than that. How on earth could such a beautiful creature be the mother of that middle-aged layabout, Brookie Harewood? She wore a smart, dark suit with an oriental silk at her neck, and her fingers were afire with diamonds.
"I must apologize for Ursula,"
she said, taking my hand in hers.
"But she's fiercely protective of me. Perhaps too fiercely."
I nodded dumbly.
"In my profession, privacy is paramount, you see, and now, with all this..."
She made a wide sweep of her hands to take in the entire world.
"I understand," I said. "I'm sorry about Brookie."
She turned and took a cigarette from a silver box, lit it with a silver lighter that might have been a scale model of Aladdin's lamp, and blew out a long jet of smoke which, oddly enough, was also silver in the sunlight.
"Brookie was a good boy," she said. "But he did not grow up to be a good man. He had the fatal gift of making people believe him."
I wasn't sure what she meant, but I nodded anyway.
"His life was not an easy one," she said reflectively. "Not as easy as it might seem."
And then, quite suddenly,
"Now tell me, why have you come?"
Her question caught me by surprise.
Why had I come?
"Oh, don't be embarrassed, child. If you're here to express your condolences, you have already done so, for which I thank you.
You may leave if you wish.
Brocky was at Buckshaw, I blurted. I found him in the drawing room in the middle of the night.
I could have cut out my tongue. There was no need for his mother to know this. No need at all, and even less for me to tell her.
But part of me knew that it was safe enough. Vanetta Harewood was a professional woman. She would no more want the midnight ramblings of her son brought to light than I would.
I'm going to ask you a very great favor, Flavia. Tell the police if you must, but if you feel it isn't essential.
She had walked back to the window where she stood staring out into the past.
You see, Brookie had his demons, if you will. If there is no need to make them public, then...
I won't tell anyone, Mrs. Harewood, I said. I promise.
She turned back to me and came across the room slowly.
You're a remarkably intelligent girl, Flavia, she said.
And then, after thinking for a couple of seconds, she added,
Come with me. There's something I wish to show you.
Down a step we went, and then up another, into the part of the house whose door I had first knocked upon. Low timbered ceilings made her stoop more than once as we went from room to room.
Ursula's studio, she said,
with a wave of her hand at a room that seemed full of twigs and branches.
Basketry, she explained. Ursula is a devotee of traditional crafts. Her willow baskets have taken prizes both here and on the continent.
To tell you the truth, she went on, lowering her voice to a confidential whisper,
the smell of her chemical preparations sometimes drives me out of the house.
But then, it's all she has, poor dear.
Chemical preparations?
My ears went up like those of an old war horse at the sound of the bugle.
Mostly sulphur, she said. Ursula uses the fumes to bleach the willow withies. They end up as white as polished bones, you know. But oh dear, the smell!
I could foresee that I was going to have a late night poring over books in Uncle Tar's chemical library. Already my mind was racing ahead to the chemical possibilities of salicin. C13, H18, O7, which was discovered in willow bark in 1831 by LaRue, and good old sulphur, S. I already knew from personal experience that certain willow catkins, kept in a sealed box for several weeks, give off the most dreadful odour of dead fish, a fact which I had filed away for future use.
Through here, Mrs. Harewood said, ducking to keep her head from banging on an exceptionally low beam.
Mind your head and watch your step.
Her studio was a glorious place. Clear north light flooded in through the angled transom windows overhead, making it seem like a room suddenly stumbled upon in a forest glade. A large wooden easel stood in the light, and on it was a half-finished portrait of Flossie, the sister of Feely's friend Sheila Foster. Flossie was sitting in a large upholstered chair, one leg curled under her, petting an enormous white Persian cat that nestled in her lap. The cat, at least, looked almost human. Actually, Flossie didn't look that bad either. She was not my favourite living person, but I didn't hold that against her. The portrait captured perfectly, in a way that even a camera can't, her air of highly polished dopiness.